conversation about how so many things have changed. When you visit with your primary physician, you're also on Zoom. So we're on the other end sometimes where we're in the waiting room and then have to do the consultation. Just an entire different world as far as how we transact business. So welcome to the Court of Appeals. I'm going to ask Justin Prentice, who is marshaling for us today, to call court to order.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Cochran, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding.
Thank you. Appearing by Zoom for our oral argument calendar today, July 8, 2021. The rules of the appellate court do remain in place, although we are proceeding by Zoom, with the exception that you don't have to stand unless you would prefer to do that. Each of you will have 15 minutes to make your argument in chief. Appellate counsel, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to utilize that. I have a sign that's up on mine. There, I had to get rid of a marker that popped up on my screen. In the event there's any difficulties as far as audio or visual or something popping up like it just did on my screen, just wave your hand or say something and we'll stop the time clock so that we can find out what's wrong and what's in error. With that said, I'm going to ask Mr. Prentice to call the first case.
This is case number A201514, Everest Stables, Inc. versus Foley and Mansfield, LLP.
Mr. Stephenson, when you're ready to proceed, you have the floor. I'm muted. I'm telling you, you're muted, but I'm muted.
I'm sorry about that. Your Honor, Mark Stephenson on behalf of Everest Stables. This case is about the underlying failures of Foley and Mansfield and Thomas Paul to present the necessary evidence to the Kentucky courts in the Crestwood matter and the Canani case in California. Both cases evidenced the failure of Mr. Paul and Foley and Mansfield to complete or file next expert reports and file the necessary documents to oppose summary judgment in the Crestwood case and to provide the necessary evidence at trial in the Canani case. In Canani, the federal court had barred Mr. Nielsen from testifying under Rule 702. Research done by Foley and Mansfield in that case demonstrates that they knew that neither Mr. Canani nor Mr. Nielsen could testify because of Rule 702's existence. In the Canani case, further, they didn't present evidence of Mr. Canani or Mr. Lick's assets, wealth, or liabilities. And as such, the punitive damages claim was struck by the court after the trial was completed because of the failure to follow California law relevant to necessary evidence on punitive damages. That was simple malpractice by Mr. Paul. And Crestwood was similar in the sense that an expert report was never completed by Mr. Paul. As the courts in both Kentucky and the Sixth Circuit noted, those were preliminary reports and they were discounted. And the necessary evidence, in particular UCC statement that evidenced the fraud of Crestwood, was not presented to the court in that case. Here, the court wrongly dismissed appellant's claims for malpractice and fraud based principally upon the expert affidavit issues and wrongly dismissed the claim regarding the lost punitive damages in the Canani litigation. And with respect to the Canani litigation, obviously, in that case, the jury heard the testimony, found for Everest on all the claims presented, and awarded $50,000 in total in punitive damages against Canani and Licht. After the trial was completed, the defendants brought a motion to dismiss the punitive claims because certain necessary evidence wasn't presented.
Tell us how that works in California. What should Mr. Paul have done? I mean, I understand this revelation you need to make about the financial status of an individual, but how does that play out? What does he do in order to have that done?
Well, there has to be discovery and evidence presented as to Mr. Canani's assets, liabilities, and net worth, essentially. The same with Mr. Lick. As Mr. Paul testified, and it's in the record.
I guess what I'm getting at, Mr. Stephenson, at what point in the proceedings should or could that be done?
That should have been presented during the regular trial as a part of the proceedings, as I understand it, because I believe that the jury considered all of the various claims along with the punitive damages claims in one setting at trial. Here in Minnesota, usually I think it's done separately but sometimes it's done jointly.
That's what I'm getting at. And I couldn't find, this record is voluminous. And that was one thing I couldn't find is, you know, maybe this is a situation that after a jury renders a verdict that you have the ability then to supplement the record and show whatever you need to do. And it's a mechanical action by the court versus a jury determination. So what you're saying is it is part of the jury consideration?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And the jury did consider it and awarded the, I believe it was $35,000 against Mr. Canani and $15,000 against Mr. Lick or something.
You misunderstood my question. The jury considers the financial status of the individual rather than the court doing that as a more of an administrative matter?
That's correct. The jury considers it and they determine the amount of punitives to be awarded. And as Mr. Paul testified, and it's before the court, he knowingly and intentionally failed to present that evidence because he didn't want to concentrate on the distinguishing factors between Mr. Nielsen and Ever Stables and the two defendants. Even though, as respondents note in their brief, that information was before the jury repeatedly, the distinguishing factors of the wealth. So they really, once the jury heard about it in the first place, there's no reason to not have presented that evidence. Mr. Paul simply failed to do it and committed malpractice when he did. I think that when it brings us to really what this is really a seminal issue, a first impression from Minnesota. And really, as you look throughout the country, the majority of the cases that have dealt with attorney malpractice regarding punitive damages have found that in the claim against the attorney, that those type of damages are compensatory damages. Essentially, they're part and parcel of the damages that plaintiff can seek against an attorney who's committed malpractice. We've cited, I think, a series of cases from the Elliott case in Arizona, the Scannamillo case in Colorado, the Hunt case in Kansas, the Heiberg case in South Dakota, the Jacobson case in the District of Columbia, amongst others. And I think that really makes sense. I mean, here it was the attorney's decision not to pursue that evidence or present that evidence. It was his malpractice. He didn't consult with Ever Stables about it. He simply did it. It was his failure. And it simply is. Yes.
Mr. Stephenson, the district court in its order focused on the purpose of punitive damages in deciding this issue and cited case law stating that the purpose of punitive damages under Minnesota law is to deter reckless or oppressive conduct. And so what public policy is supported by allowing recovery of damages on a malpractice claim against an attorney for punitive damages where the purpose of, so essentially recovery from a third party as opposed to the party that engaged in the reckless or oppressive conduct. How is that consistent with public policy and the underlying purpose of punitive damages?
I think that you're addressing the Ferguson case, and I think the Ferguson case is a 4-3 decision, and of course it has the complicating factor that it was a class action where someone could have opted out. I think that here the public purpose is simply that when you commit a malpractice like this, that there's no public policy that prevents someone from recovering against their attorney for that malpractice. That's what those various cases I have cited to the court talk about, that really when the attorney commits this type of malpractice, that they are responsible. As the Ferguson dissent noted, the client is a victim twice over. Only the attorney is blameworthy for the failure to follow the rules. And it went on to say that no public policy forbids such compensations. I think that is clearly what the intent here is that this type of malpractice should not be sanctioned by saying that public policy bars the recovery. Essentially, the client is the one who's being punished twice. First, he was victimized by Canani and Lick by their fraud, breach of fiduciary duty, and essential theft. And then he's being victimized once again by the attorney's failure to present evidence that he knew was necessary for his claim. I mean, if you're not going to present the evidence that's necessary for the claim, you should have just dismissed the claim and not pursued it at all.
I understand your argument, Mr. Stephenson, but the district court in this case chose to follow legal principles that have been adopted by other states. And I mean, we don't pick and choose, or we don't have a popularity poll to decide which principles we should follow. So how did the district court err when it made a decision based on the knowledge that that different jurisdictions follow different procedures? Where do we find error on the district court on that? Or is that simply your argument of public policy?
Well, I think that that issue is, first of all, one that's considered de novo by this court. It's, you know, it's an issue of law of first impression that this court can decide. It has a right to decide what it believes should be how this state addresses these type of claims. I believe that the public policy should be allowed clients to recover the damages that are caused by their attorney's malpractice. The ability to bring a claim for malpractice allows you to recover the damages that are caused by your attorney's malpractice. And in this case, those damages, as all those other cases talk about, are the compensatory damages that include punitive damages. I think that is really what the public policy should be. We shouldn't be sanctioning attorneys' malpractice or willful conduct that diminishes a recovery by their client.
Mr. Stephenson, could I shift gears just a little bit?
Sure.
I wanted to inquire about one of the arguments as to an error by the court was the failure to consider safe harbor provision in the statute in terms of the inadequacies, as the court had ruled, of the affidavit. And my question to you is, it seemed we're arguing that it was simply a matter of, I think you used the phrase minor error there, that seems to be the distinction in the affidavits, and yet the court's ruling seems to be based substantively on the requirements of the statute that need to be in the affidavit initially. And so isn't it true, when you look at the cases from Brooks, Brown, Wilbert, and onward, that the whole purpose of the statute is a heightened level than even the rules of civil procedures, meaning that if minor, which it sounded to me, if I understand the distinction of the court's ruling, this was major because it was substantive. How would that be an error for the court to conclude, therefore, that it was error not to consider the safe harbor provision for your client's affidavit?
First of all, Your Honor, under the safe harbor provision under 544.42, I think it's important to first understand that the statute does not have a major versus minor distinction. That is a distinction that was created by the Supreme Court in the Guzik case, and it has been gone forward since. I think that's important as we look at the dissent from Justice Lilyhaug, that really that isn't what the statute says or was intended to do.
Mr. Stephenson, as an error-correcting court, though, aren't we bound by that precedent?
I believe you are. I can't say that you aren't. I think it's important for the court to consider that when it considers the intention of the major versus minor distinction. You know, the major versus minor distinction, I think the major distinction really should be, you know, is the affidavit one that is simply put in at the last second that isn't fulfilling the intent of the statute. Here, this is a 28-page affidavit that goes through each of the claims. It sets forth the reasoning behind what the basis for each of those claims were. I know that the Judge Abrams determined that he felt that these were major deficiencies, not minor deficiencies, and therefore the safe harbor provision didn't apply. We believe that was a mistake. That was an error of law by him to make that distinction and not give us the availability of the safe harbor. I think that the corresponding medical malpractice statute now, 145.682, shows that the state legislature intended for deficiencies to be allowed to be corrected. And that certainly is allowed now in a medical malpractice case. It should similarly be allowed in this type of case where deficiencies can be corrected. These are minor deficiencies that could have been corrected, but they would not have been provided the availability of that alternative because of the Georgia's order.
Would you agree, Mr. Stephenson, that whether in the legal, accounting, or in the medical, though, if for instance, the court rules that a particular standard of care has not been identified, that would be a major deficiency?
Well, I think that in this situation, that may, that identification of the standard of care issue can be disputed whether or not it was fully addressed in the actual affidavit. I think that Mr. Cathy, who was obviously Everest's former counsel, believed that this affidavit fully complied with what the statute required, and he presented it as such. And that's where I think the real intent of the statute should allow those type of, you know, deficiencies to be corrected. You know, the court cases clearly indicate that these cases shouldn't be dismissed on technicalities, that litigants should be allowed to pursue their claims fully. And when this type of technicality bars their claim, we really aren't fulfilling what the other cases talk about when we talk about technicalities versus, you know, having cases decide on their merits. I just want to briefly address the fraud issues too. I think that the fraud issues here, first of all, the Hoyt case is the most applicable case involving attorney statements and representations of fact and preparation and other items. The Hoyt case, along with the Osterlin case, clearly sets forth that the types of statements made by Mr. Paul are actionable. And then also with respect to the various other fraud claims that were dismissed for the failure of an expert report, we believe that was error as well, because certainly there is no requirement in a fraud claim to have an expert. We believe that the majority of these claims, if not all, can be understood by the ordinary jury, and there is no need for an expert to testify with respect to any of those issues. And I see that my time is expiring.
Good timing. Mr. Stephenson, you'll have 5 minutes, as I indicated in my preliminary remarks. We'll turn now to Mr. Jones.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. And before I get going, I thank you again for your indulgence on my technical errors. Thank you. I know I probably put back the whole schedule, so I apologize. Maybe I'll try to give some of my time back here. But may it please the court, I have the honor of representing Foley and Mansfield and Thomas Paul, in this case, the respondents. And we are here this morning to ask your honors to affirm the judgment in their favor. And that judgment, your honors, resulted from three underlying orders. There's one on March 5, 2018, in which Judge Abrams denied the motion to extend the expert reports and affidavit deadline. September 9, 2019, where Judge Abrams granted much, not all, of our motion under 544.42, and then the summary judgment order on October 2, 2020 with Judge Moore. All three of these orders, Your Honor, and I think Judge Werke noted that this is a very large record, and it certainly is. And all three of those orders demonstrate a command of this very large and complex record. The judges clearly did a lot of work, or maybe their law clerks did the work. I'll say that, having been a law clerk myself. And but there's a lot of work that was done there to obtain command of the record, go through everything very carefully, very detailed, very reasoned orders, and there simply is no basis for this court to reverse those orders. And we ask that they be affirmed. One point I'll make just in passing, and I made it very briefly in our brief, I think there's a lack of compliance with Appellate Rule 128 here. There's very few citations to the record, very few, just a couple of examples. Almost all of page 6 on the principal brief, there's no citation at all. Page 7 in the principal brief, Paul was aware prior to attempting to disclose Nielsen as an expert that this attempt would fail. There's no cite for that. Page 13, Paul had no intent to use local counsel. There's no citation for that. In the reply brief, page 3, Nielsen's health issues did not affect the jury decision making. There's no citation for that. And we would dispute all of those statements. There's just no citation for them. There's a long list of others, which I will not get into. Going back to the substance of our arguments, Your Honor, this is a legal malpractice case, as I think you all very definitely recognize. And the sine qua non here is but for causation. And as Judge Abrams noted, Everest assumes without explanation that all of Everest's claims were viable and Everest would have won but for defendant's failings. That's on page 17. And that, I think, is true through this entire case. We heard this morning from appellant's counsel that my clients failed to introduce the necessary evidence. What evidence? what evidence was not introduced that would have enabled Everest to satisfy this but-for causation standard? There has been precious little, if any. I'll address one possible example, but other than that, there's only been one example of anything that would have been introduced that could even potentially have changed the result. And I would say there's nothing that's been put forward that would have changed the result.
Mr. Jones, I'm going to inquire, and perhaps this is the one example you were going to mention, but Mr. Stephenson led off with discussion about the punitive damages. Now, isn't that the one area of all of them where quite clearly, it seems to me at least, because of the court's ruling afterwards, that evidence was not presented? And also it appears on its face, although the dollar amount might be in question, I suppose, but the but-for seems to be met because the jury actually awarded it. Can you comment on that, please?
Yeah, I would respectfully disagree with Your Honor on that point, because what California law does say, if we take Everest's argument and if we take the judge's ruling, what the law does say is that you need specific evidence of the defendant's net worth. Now, one of our points, I'll just put this aside, is that there was evidence of net worth that was presented. There was evidence of financial gain on the transactions that was presented. There's case law that supports that view, but the federal judge disagreed with my client. And so the award was entered. But if you take that view of California law seriously, then the absolute requirement is that you need evidence of net worth. That evidence, according to the plaintiff, was not presented. So it's completely speculative, and Judge Moore recognized this, to say that an award that was entered in the absence of the required evidence would have been the same in the presence of that evidence. It's completely speculative to say that. So I would suggest, Your Honor, that there is really no evidence at all on that point. It's completely speculative.
Do you have, maybe just to follow up, I'm curious, from your client's standpoint, what sort of evidence in the affidavit would you have expected to receive to satisfy the expert analysis and avoid dismissal on that particular count?
Well, so actually on that point, Judge Sleater, Judge Abrams said that the affidavit was sufficient on that specific limited point, that the expert disclosure affidavit was sufficient. And so that's why we went to summary judgment with Judge Moore on that issue. So I disagreed with Judge Abrams on that point. I thought an expert should have come up with something to explain again how an award that was entered without the evidence would be the same with the evidence. But Judge Abrams disagreed with me, so we went to summary judgment on that point.
And so the point on that, obviously, there was still no evidence, no genuine issue material fact, as Judge Moore ruled, on the damages, hence the dismissal of that claim.
Right, because it was speculative. And then his alternative basis, of course, was the public policy issue, the recoverability of punitive damages. That was the second reason for that decision.
Mr. Jones, just to clarify, is it speculative as to the amount or speculative as to whether there would have been an award at all if the financial information had been presented?
I think both, Your Honor. We would say both.
And why is that?
Well, because I do agree with Mr. Stephenson on one thing. There was a lot of testimony at the Kanani trial about the financial disparity between Mr. Nielsen, who was a very wealthy man, and Mr. Kanani and Mr. Licht, who are not very wealthy people at all. Mr. Licht represented himself at the trial. We have the actual verdict form, which you put in the record, where the jury does find in favor of Mr. Nielsen, or rather his company, on these various points. But if they had specific evidence as to the actual net worth of Kanani and Licht, which for all we know may have been less than zero, I think it's well within the range of reason to say they wouldn't have awarded punitive damages at all. So I think it's speculative on both points, Your Honor.
I have one additional question on the punitive damage issue, and that goes to the public policy behind the position you're taking, which is, I think, that there shouldn't be damages awarded for a claim, a malpractice claim, based on that relates to a claim for punitive damages.
Right.
And so how does your position promote public policy where it would appear to allow an attorney to escape responsibility for the consequences of malpractice where the malpractice relates to a claim of punitive damages? And just this is hypothetically, I'm not talking specifically about this case, but just as a matter of general principle.
I understand that, Your Honor. And I think the concern, I think we have to acknowledge the legitimacy of the concern, but I think that concern is overridden by the overall purposes of what punitive damages are about. And the fact that, punitive damages are not compensatory. So we're asking a different person to compensate somebody for something that wasn't compensatory to begin with. What punitive damages are is a windfall to the plaintiff. So you're asking somebody to be compensated for what under the law is deemed to be a windfall. So I think that addresses your concern, Judge Cochran. And what it really does is, this is something that Judge Moore observed in his order, asking the attorney to compensate the plaintiff for the punitive damages really in effect turns the attorney into an insurer of the punitive damages award in these kinds of situations. And Judge Moore cited the, now I've lost the citation here, I'll come up with it in a second. He cited the Rosenbloom versus Flygar case, where the Supreme Court held that punitive damages are not insurable as a matter of law. Now, granted, that's a little bit of a different concept, but I think what Judge Moore is saying is that all these points support his position and reinforce his position that they should not be recoverable under Minnesota law. What I'd like to do here is then move to a discussion of Judge Abrams' order in September of 2019. I'll move past the decision of Judge Abrams denying the motion to extend, unless Your Honor has any questions about that, because I'm down to about 5 minutes here. Except I want to make one real quick point on that. There are two kinds of expert disclosures here. There's the affidavit under the statute, and then there's the signed report under the rules. Ever sought an extension with respect to both. The motion was denied with respect to both. They're two different kinds of disclosures. They both have purposes under the rules and under the statute, and that point really has not been disputed. And that becomes important because Judge Moore later finds that there is no expert report available to support many of these claims that Everest has made. And that, so that has a follow-on effect with Judge Moore's order that I think is very important. But let me turn back to Judge Abrams' September order. There was a claim a few moments ago from Everest that the allegations were minor, words to that effect. Judge Abrams found to the contrary over and over and over again in his long opinion on that topic. And we respectfully submit that this court should affirm those decisions. These were very major substantive decisions. The affidavit was long, no question about that. But nobody should confuse quantity for quality. And over and over and over again, what the affidavit says is things like the necessary evidence without telling us what that evidence should have been. That's the main flaw in the report. But as Judge Slater acknowledged a few moments ago, it doesn't say what the standard of care would have been on several points. And Judge Abrams went through the affidavit piece by piece and found over and over again instances where key evidence or key discussions were not present in the affidavit, weren't mentioned at all. Just as examples, he said, Everest affidavit fails to adequately address the crucial causation element. The affidavit was almost silent on issues. Over and over again, Judge Abrams makes those observations because they're correct. If you look at the affidavit, it is silent on these questions. It never identifies the necessary evidence. It never tells the reader what could have been done that would have been different. And in that regard, Your Honors, we get back again to but-for causation. And I don't want to let my time slip without noting that these cases weren't very good. These were terrible cases. If you go back and you look at it with the lens of time, you realize that Crestwood, the Crestwood case involved an agreement that was very one-sided. My client had nothing to do with that agreement. It was drafted before he ever came on the scene. And so we had to get around that agreement to try to craft a case. In the Kanani case, we have evidence that Mr. Nielsen sold his horses to Mr. Kanani, who turned around and flipped them. Sure, but the jury eventually said, a pox on both your houses. What happened was that Mr. Nielsen panicked and sold his horses into the worst down market in the history of the world, practically, in the economic crisis of 2008. And if you look at the federal court cases arising out of the Crestwood case, that point is made by both Judge Caldwell and the Sixth Circuit. So these were terrible cases. And Mr. Paul went through mountains of discovery to try to prove the cases on behalf of his client. Never once in the affidavit does the writer identify a deposition that should have been taken, some documents that could have been obtained, any other evidence that was out there. That's just not present at all, over and over and over again. So we ask your honors to affirm Judge Abrams' determination on those points. Excuse me, getting over a cold. Another example would be the two-step salsa claim in the Kanani case. There's a statement in the appellate brief from the appellant about how the documents should have been obtained. Well, what documents? Never in this case was there ever any attempt to obtain those documents or find out what they really would have said or how they would have supported Everest's case regarding two-step salsa course. So over and over again, that problem affects these cases. So we're here again this morning to ask your honors to affirm these decisions and affirm the judgment in favor of my clients. I got 32 seconds.
I presume then you're conceding that 27 seconds.
I am.
All right, thank you, Mr. Jones. And Mr. Stephenson, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that I want to just address a few of the issues raised by Mr. Jones. First of all, with respect to documents that should have been provided, obviously the UCC document was never provided to the court. It's a fundamental document that demonstrates fraud. It represents that Patient Bill, a very valuable horse, a $6.5 million horse, was now being represented as being owned by Crestwood. It wasn't owned by Crestwood. It was bank fraud. That provided the distinct reason for fraud by Crestwood and the underlying cases, but it was never presented by Mr. Paul. In fact, he refused to present it to the court. With respect to two-step salsa, the documents that are referenced in the affidavit talk about certain documents that should have been obtained from Mr. Avila, respecting the transactions between Kanani, Licht, and Avila that would have shown the interactions and would have shown what the actual damages were. Mr. Jones oftentimes talks about Mr. Nielsen panicking. He didn't panic. It's a part of, he decided that he needed to sell some horses. He did move forward with the deal with Crestwood and Mr. Kanani, but Mr. Kanani, in his case, he represented these horses were injured. There were problems with the horses. That's why they were sold. He represented that falsely. And that's what the jury in California found, that they breached the fiduciary duties. With respect to the expert opinion that was raised, respect to the expert, I'll call their reports, it was an abuse of discretion to deny the request for the extension. Judge Abrams heard the motion on that issue. Obviously, they were requesting a simple 30-day extension. They provided the expert reports within the 30 days. They were provided by Mr. Cathy in a timely fashion under his request. There was an abuse of discretion by the court in denying those reports because, quite frankly,
Mr. Stephenson, with regard to that point, the statute requires good cause for an extension unless there's agreement by the parties, and it's my understanding there wasn't agreement by the parties. So given the timing here, correct me if I have the dates wrong, but wasn't the request for an extension made just, like a week or less prior to the filing date under the scheduling order? And in those circumstances, how did the district court abuse its discretion in determining there wasn't a showing of good cause?
That's correct on the timing, Your Honor. I think that what the record reflects by Mr. Cathy is that He learned in November that additional materials were needed. They sought that additional discovery. He learned that shortly before the reports were going to be due that they weren't going to be ready in time, and then requested an extension from Mr. Jones, which was denied. And then he sought the motion to extend the time for the reports. I think what's important here with respect to the abuse of discretion is that the trial wasn't scheduled at this point in time. The discovery was ongoing. There certainly was an allowance within the court's calendar and schedule to allow for an extension because the reports were unable to be completed because of unforeseen consequences related to the experts. And so I think that a 30-day extension certainly could have and should have been granted, and it was abuse of discretion not to grant that extension. I think that a couple of the things I want to address quickly with respect to the punitive issues is this: when they talk about this being speculative, it seems to me that that is an argument that could then be used with every single attorney malpractice case ever. You fail to provide evidence at trial, and you're being sued for malpractice. The answer is, well, it's speculative what the result would have been to a jury if I had presented that evidence, what the damages would have been. Same as if, you know, I've had a statute of limitations run. You know, it's only speculative as to what the damages would have been in the underlying case if it actually started in time. The concept that the damages would be speculative because of the failures of Mr. Paul to present the necessary evidence in trial seems to be a very red herring. It's what it always would be with every single attorney malpractice case. Essentially, there couldn't be any attorney malpractice cases going forward because all the damages would be speculative as to what could have been awarded if the attorney would have done his job right. And then I think that with respect to the trial, I think it's important to understand that Mr. Blick is an attorney and he worked hand in hand with Mr. Canani in his attorney in the litigation. And, you know, when you really get down to it, the cases that were cited on the punitives, you know, insurance is a different issue. And I think that my time has expired.
Thank you. I want to thank both attorneys for appearing on our Zoom Gov platform. Matters were very well argued and are helpful to this court in terms of interpreting the scope of our work. A decision will be issued within the statutory timeframe.